Welcome to Flip Table Theology, a weekly conversation centered around flipping tables of oppression, injustice, privilege, division, and religion as acts of faith and worship.
We are so excited you guys are joining us at this table. Grab a cup of coffee or a cup of tea and let's dive in.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Flip Table Theology. This one probably sounds a little bit differently. We are currently doing a Flip Table Live at National Avenue Christian Church in Springfield, Missouri. So we're excited to have more people in the room than normal. So thank you to everyone that's here to engage in this conversation with us. We are having a conversation tonight around Christian nationalism, and we felt like it was a great place to come and have this conversation here at National Avenue because y'all are currently engaged in kind of an in-depth study with your faith community around this topic. So we wanted to come and kind of engage with that as well and make this an element of that conversation. So we've got a couple of guests tonight with us from National Avenue Christian Church. So I'm just going to kind of round robin the table really quickly for everyone to introduce themselves. So I'm Christy Love, host of Flip Table Theology, and I'm going to go this way and let everyone introduce themselves.
I'm Holly Madden. I'm also on Flip Table Theology regularly.
I'm Reverend Candace Adams, member of National Avenue Christian Church, and I'm teaching the class on Christian nationalism here at the church.
Awesome. We're glad to have you tonight, Candace.
I'm Phil Snyder, and I am also part of the Flip Table podcast team.
Sherita Thomas Tate, Flip Table Theology member.
I'm Jen Simmons, and I'm lead pastor at National Avenue Christian Church.
Very good.
I also feel like we need to have a shout out to Scott and Bob, who have helped our sound for like the last hour. So thank you for your efforts. They're the like invisible, silent, honorary Flip Table sidekicks.
Absolutely. This is either going to sound great to podcast listeners or a hot train wreck. We'll see what happens. So, all right, y'all. Well, let's dive into this topic. And I want to start by asking, how do you define Christian nationalism for yourself? I'm not necessarily asking you to quote a pre-existing definition, but for you, when you think about Christian nationalism, how do you define that? And I'll kind of throw mine out and then we'll kind of popcorn around the room. I've thought about this a lot this week leading up to this conversation, and I think the way that I would define it the best is idolatry of the American dream. So that's my definition. How about you?
I want to jump in before all these other folks get in. They're good at definitions, so because I don't know that I have a whole lot to contribute today. I'm not feeling the best. I think of Christian nationalism as a conflagrance of faith and patriotism.
So I am going to do the thing you said not to do, but I think Andrew Whitehead has given me a grounding that has been so helpful, so I'm going to throw it on the table and then work backwards from it. To help frame, as a sociologist would help us to hold, a cultural framework that idealizes and emphasizes this fusion of a particular kind of Christianity in conversation and in conjunction with American civic life. Mm-hmm. And the way he unpacks this idea of Christianity has been helpful, and I hope we get to unpack more of that. Mm-hmm. But like quickly for me, it's this idea that we are in a nation where we get to be Christian. This is not a Christian nation. Huh. Anytime I have seen that quote, yes, that so quickly sums it up for me, that we don't live in a Christian nation. We get to practice our faith in this space together.
Mm-hmm.
Snap, snap, snap.
Mm. How about you, Candy?
Well, I see Christian nationalism, and as far as the two words, you know, they're not supposed to be together. Mm-hmm. Separation of church and state is very important for our country. And Christian nationalism is trying to push them together. And a particular brand of Christianity and a particular way of seeing nationalism, too, mm-hmm. or patriotism. And when you combine them together, it's cause for violence, really. Mm-hmm. You know, like defense, and I'm, you know, trying to defend their faith and mm-hmm. how it's important to them. Well, we're where does nationalism come in there?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're going to come back to a couple of the things that you just said, because I think you hit on some really important stuff. How about you, Holly? How do you define Christian nationalism?
I'm trying to think of things that are fresh. I think to me, when I center on the core history of what America was, and to honor the country of immigrants, the country of immigrants that came into a place founded already with incredible communities that lived here and called America home, this desire for freedom. And to me, when I think of Christian nationalism, I see so much control, I see so much forcing of specific belief systems and perspectives, which is the complete antithesis of what America was actually supposed to be. And I know there's an incredible amount of mess when you talk about settlers coming over to a country that was already full of people and the oppression and the harm that was caused there. But the idea of so many of those people to come pursue freedom, to believe the way they wanted, is the complete opposite of this modern movement that is trying to force beliefs and trying to push other beliefs lower and seen as less than. And there's just a lot of toxicness that is in that. So,
you know, I would also throw into this that in addition to fusions and intersections and all of these spaces, there's also this sanctification of forcing and of violence and of, you know, kind of dismissing of different beliefs and different ideologies in this country that comes across with this very much like, we're going to sanitize and sanctify this as holy because we want to wrap it in scriptural language and these pursuits then and whatever comes out of that as holy, which is really, really concerning for a lot of reasons. So talk to me, you guys, about your own experience. Like, how has Christian nationalism impacted you as a human, as a pastor, as a community leader, whatever that looks like? So, Jen, I'm going to start with you.
Thinking about this one, knowing this was coming, I don't know that I felt the direct impact necessarily, although I can remember serving as a pastor the fight about the flag and the flag needing to be in churches, and sometimes the games that I know pastor have played about, like trying to move it out of the space. And I feel like, yeah, you know.
It has mysteriously disappeared from Brentwood several times over many years. And then we were glad that at one point along the way, everybody forgot, and it hasn't been up there since.
So that, which that one feels like one of the, not the major impacts of this. But recently I've really been struck by a conversation with a colleague who's in a Baptist church and saying, I see that this is not okay. What do I do?
Yeah.
And the inability to have conversation, and then those of us who've been impacted by family members, that we don't know how to talk to each other about this. And that's where I have a lot of concern. I mean, I have concern about government and policies and structures, and I feel the impact, but I know I don't fully feel the impact, but it's in those conversations that we don't know how to talk to each other and the brokenness that it is causing that I have a real heart for. That I've sat with folks trying to figure that one out. How do I do Thanksgiving? How are we going to do Christmas? We can't talk about anything, and this is too hard. So that's one place.
Yeah. And I think there's so many of those embedded symbols, right? And the flag is an important one of those symbols and has played an important role. And that's not dismissing that, but it becomes very complicated, and the emotions around those symbols then become incredibly heightened and triggering when we try to have conversations around them. So how about you, Sherita?
Do we want to talk about the flag? So for those of you who are aware or not aware, last year when I was running for re-election, I was crucified for being a board member who does not say the Pledge of Allegiance during our board meetings. And the rhetoric around it was Dr. Thomas Tate hates America because she doesn't say the Pledge of Allegiance. And Christian language put into the rhetoric around my identity and what I believed and what I didn't believe and who I was based on my choice to not say the Pledge of Allegiance. Personally, I've been at two large white evangelical churches before where I was heavily involved, and twice now, I've also had to leave those churches because of white Christian nationalism. And I say white Christian nationalism because it's a very different experience from the experience that I've had in black churches. Not that they don't have their set of issues, but that idea of how patriotism plays out. I know that every black church I've ever attended celebrates our veterans. We celebrate those who have given service to this country, but we don't say the Pledge of Allegiance. I mean, we separate that idea of my faith being connected to my celebration of being in this country. I think part of it is because we come from a history where Christianity was used to exclude me and my ancestors from our history, and then legislated to include us, but continues to exclude us through Christian rhetoric. So I think that's, you know, I have a tension of having these two different experiences with regards to Christian nationalism.
I think too, Sherita, and I don't know if you would agree with this or not, I think you would, but I feel like in the polarization that comes around Christian nationalism, there's also this element of just like dehumanizing one another in the name of nationalism mm-hmm. and in the name of Christianity, which is so ironically weird that we would dehumanize in the name mm-hmm. of Christ, who calls us to humanize and to see and to love people. But like, I'm not taking the time to hear your reasoning or ask you your beliefs or why you choose to do different things. We're just going to make assumptions and label and then build rhetoric around that that becomes incredibly toxic and hostile.
Yeah, but even when we do ask you, we don't really care because we've already made up our mind about who you are because of your choice not to put your hand over your heart and say this pledge to this flag.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm grateful to be an American. I love being an American, but that's a choice that I make, and I live in a country that allows me that freedom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. I think a lot of the project of Christian nationalism as it's manifested today is just a continuation of the long history of the United States in subjugating folks that don't conform to a certain way of being. And whenever we trace the history of how we got to where we are today, we find that so often the movements about, you know, what it means to be a true American is very frequently related to what it means to be a true American in the sense of conforming to straight, cis, white, male normativity. And within the context of churches, like, so I grew up in white evangelical spaces, and I didn't even recognize the nationalism going on. It's kind of like a fish in water. Mm-hmm. It's like you're swimming around in the water, but you don't recognize the water.
Yeah.
And so like all the times there were the pledges to Pledge of Allegiance, all the times that we had just religious you know, ceremonies as part of a worship service, just the flag being up there at the front of the sanctuary without even really thinking about it. And the way those things, you know, would go together. So kind of like ideology functions when you don't recognize it.
Mm.
And so I just grew up not recognizing what I was participating in. But then when you begin to talk about kind of the history of nationalism and why does it become all of a sudden so controversial, it's because it has to do with the way that power is structured in our society.
Yeah. And I feel like you're not alone in that, right? There are so many people that were raised with a heavy overtone of Christian nationalism that didn't really start to recognize the impact of it until 2016, until 2020, until we saw some of these images on January 6th playing out on our televisions and having to wrestle with, how did we get here? And then starting to recognize all of the dominoes that had been set in motion for more than a generation of that level of acceptance and just not recognizing there was an issue with that culture. Yeah. How about you, Candy?
Well, the January 6th thing just, you know, I mean, that affected me personally, affected everybody. You know, it was just heartbreaking. And the symbolism, I mean, you watch those videos, I mean, they keep showing them over and over again, but you look at this Christian symbol throughout the whole riot. I call it a riot, but mm-hmm. it just affected me and a lot of people I know, and that to me is an experiencing Christian nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that it was on television for that long and we all saw it,
yeah.
and now they're out there denying it happened,
mm-hmm.
you know, what kind of world do we live in? that denies reality when we have a way to see reality that we didn't have years ago.
Can we name the irony? I'm thinking about Pledge of Allegiance, flag. I remember when Colin Kaepernick took a knee, not protesting America, but, you know, police brutality within America. And he was cast as being completely unpatriotic, un-American, all that kind of stuff, by the very same folk who literally stormed government buildings on January the 6th, claiming to be patriotic. Let's just name that irony. And also pay attention to what is the common denominator.
And I think, unfortunately, there's such a long history of rewriting history to fit the narrative of the moment and make that narrative fluid. And, you know, it's very, very messy, very messy. How about you, Paul?
I think something that I just kind of was processing was, like, how much this ingrained prioritization of, like, or beliefs of just, like, idolatry, I guess is the right word of that, of both, like, America and then both Christianity, and like the dehumanization of it is like the people that suffer the most are those that are the most at risk. Those are the most vulnerable, those who have most likely experienced the most trauma. And to think of like this elevation of our country that's been embedded in this belief system, and like the amount of people that live in our country who don't feel lucky to be here the way that so many, especially white, wealthy people do and expect, like, oh, well, if you come here, you're lucky, you're one of the lucky ones. And to come to systems where they are, you know, forced to live in extreme poverty, where there's these incredibly difficult to understand processes and things like that, and just like to completely dehumanize their experience, and how many people are here because it's unsafe to live in their own country, or because of war, because of horrible actions that they have suffered, that they've lived through, and to minimize because of the value of what we credit this country to be, and we credit it to be on the same level of these Christian ethics or beliefs and things like that. And it just, it's the complete, you know, I always go back to like the Jesus of Nazareth, who would like sleep on the streets and like invite himself over to dinner and just like want to spend time with the people that were considered outcasts. And Christian nationalism is anything but that type of just loving people.
You know, I spent a lot of time the last couple of weeks in preparation conversation reading sermon transcripts and just public comments and political speeches from individuals who have a very Christian nationalist tone in their rhetoric and in their sermons. And one of the things that I noticed that kind of touches with what you just said, Holly, is how much of that rhetoric leans on the Old Testament. Promises of the Old Testament and verses from the Old Testament that are pulled out of context and used in different ways. And I just keep like wrestling in myself and thinking, at no point, though, should Scripture ever cancel out Scripture. And we treat these Old Testament passages in those contexts like they somehow cancel out the call to love and the call to follow in the teachings of Jesus. And you hear a lot of language from faith leaders using this tone that also talk about like how Jesus has been overly feminized, or he's been toned down and he needs to be remasculinized. Anyway, made to be more masculine. And like this idea of trying to like bring Jesus into a more macho framework that fits some of that Old Testament rhetoric. So talk, you've got a face, Jen, so process
many,
with me.
So many faces. So, I mean, thinking about it, it's such bullshit. It's just such bullshit.
Amen.
I mean, the way patriarchy, and like toxic masculinity and the role that has played.
Yes.
In so many, in the undertones of these conversations in history, of the unwellness and the, it is just heartening to me to hear that and know like that is a common thread. And I, like, kudos to you. I couldn't have spent time. I would have like broken many devices and thrown things at that point. But
I ate a lot of chocolate.
So I feel like we're glasses of wine. I don't know.
Yeah, all the things.
But the Old Testament as well, it's so abusive to take it out of this Jewish context and understanding better rhetoric. And again, the heart of somebody, which we're all bringing different things to it. but just to misuse and abuse this man who walked alongside people, who listened so well, the teaching to use the text in that way,
right,
in this framework. But the, one of the questions and things, like, I wonder about the toxic masculinity and fear as a part of this conversation. Because that is an undertone that we as a society and culture do not do a good job of dealing well with. And the church has made it horrific.
And there's many aspects of fear, I think, to be named. Right. So, like, Sharita, I think about you. You were talking earlier. For those of you that don't know, Sharita was talking in reference to being a local school board member here. And, like, there's fear, I think, from public individuals who fear if their motives, their beliefs are taken out of context or are framed in a certain way, they lose control of that on their own. I think there's fear of if I say something, if I question, you know, I'm going to be a victim of cancel culture. Like, you know, people are going to gang up on me and all of these horrible, like the react of that space and the fear that's in that. I mean, I understand it because it's present and we see its effects all the time.
I used to argue that, you know, oh, these folks are just, they're afraid that if they give me an inch, that they're going to lose an inch. And then, you know what? They are. They are going to lose an inch. They're going to lose something. And I, when someone pointed that out to me one time, they're like, they act like there's not enough pie for everyone. You know, and there's a pie. And if they give me a slice, they're going to run out of pie. Someone said they might, and they will lose the pie. And I think part of it is understanding the power structure behind it, this idea of the history of this white patriarchy, and how that has held on. They've had a stronghold on power in decision making in this country for so long that, yes, they are afraid of losing that power.
Yeah. Well, and one of the themes that we also hear a lot in this rhetoric that you talk about right there, Sharita, is the them language, right? It's this us versus them. And I think when we heard this overtone of the, you know, reclaim our country, make America great again kind of language, it was this idea that they have taken something from us. And it just sets us up for this incredibly oppositional kind of existence.
Mm-hmm. Which, that it's an intentional thing, right?
100%.
You know, we go back to the roots of white supremacy in the United States and the way that very powerful people wanted to divide folk. And so you have, you know, white supremacy that, you know, someone who maybe is not a wealthy white person at all, you know, feels like, oh, but I'm still better than this person of color. And you know, and that is a system and structure put in place in order to divide people and at the same time keep the attention from the power structures that fundamentally need to be transfigured, reconformed, however. And then I even go back to conversations. I don't know how we keep these within 45 minutes because there's so much to talk about. I think about, you know, the way that scripture is used so often and like tensions within the Hebrew Bible itself. There's like, you know, these passages that almost like could define the ways in which different people view nationalism today. So on the one hand, you have voices that talk about, you know, being centered around just only certain people are part of the tribe, and don't let in any of the foreigners or don't marry any foreigners, anything like that. But then you also have these voices, you know, that break down all of those walls. You know, I think about Isaiah, you know, who is frustrated with what is in the book of Deuteronomy. Whenever Deuteronomy is being very particular and exclusive, Isaiah comes in and says, no, you got it all wrong. You know, my house shall be called a house of prayer for all people, you know, including eunuchs, including foreigners. And so even within the text itself, there's this vast room for inclusion and justice. And so paying attention to the parts of the Bible that are read and cited says a lot about, you know, what people want to hold on to, and says more about the power that they want as opposed to what the text might be saying. Because, you know, people tend to go to the text to get what they want out of the text rather than to have the text inform them.
Well, and I don't think that, you know, it would be a flip table conversation if we didn't also address,
I was thinking it,
the religious trauma aspect of Christian nationalism. Because, you know, when we talk about the different wounds in religious trauma, one of the ones we talk about a lot is the weaponization of scripture and how harmful that can be to individuals and the many ways that that is leveraged against people as a weapon and a means to hurt people and demean people when that was never the intention intent of Scripture to begin with. It was, intended to guide and to instruct and to shape and to teach. But I think we can't overlook that. And not only can we not overlook it, but I think we also have to name that there's parallel research that shows us mm-hmm. that this rise in Christian nationalism and the weaponization of Scripture that's been used on political speeches consistently since 2016, before that, obviously, as well. I mean, there's a history of it, but really this new wave that I think we've seen, we're also watching the same declines in church attendance. We're seeing, other pieces of that are lining up, because there's just kind of this perfect storm that's shaping in congregations across this country.
And not just congregations.
Oh, no.
Like Iowa, the information there mm-hmm. that so many people aren't part of churches, mm-hmm. that where they're finding this information, which is even more the isolation of it and the strangeness of that dichotomy. Like that's a whole other, people are finding such identity in it mm-hmm. And not even in community and churches. But the fascinating part about it, it's declining. Mm-hmm. It's tearing the church apart.
Absolutely.
I mean, across the board for everyone.
Absolutely.
For everyone.
Yeah.
Well, and there is so much privilege embedded in this, like, belief that, like, if everybody were to look the same, be the same, believe the same, that's, like, this thing to achieve to. Because, like, the wild world, the natural world, like, our survival as human beings from day one on this planet has depended upon diversity. Like, we require others that, like other species and organisms on this planet to be able to function in order for us to survive. And when things are bad, when there is harm being done, other species can help mitigate that trauma. And like when you think of, I grew up in Colorado in the mountains, and there are beautiful, beautiful pine trees. I like identify as a pine tree in a different life. I love pine trees. But there was this horrible experience, this epidemic, honestly, where these little pine beetles were getting into these pine trees and killing the trees in waves. And you would look at the mountain and just be these waves of brown. But there were other species of animals that were then eating these pine beetles. And what they found was it wasn't humans coming in to spray the trees. It was these other populations rising of mammals and squirrels and birds and things like that would eat these little bugs, and then eventually they actually protected the forest, and then other trees started to grow in the places where there was shadowed, where there was shadow. Everybody's laughing. I'm pulling a Holly over here, but to look at those dynamics and see how much the diversity was dependent on the survival of each and every single one of those organisms. And that's the same for humans. Like even within our own human population, like we need systems of checks and balances, and you cannot have checks and balances unless you have diversity, unless you have experiences that mold us, shape us, change us, make us better as people, and protect us and keep us surviving and keep our country becoming better and better and better. And so this insane belief system that we have to, everybody needs to be at the same level and believe the same things is so incredibly cult-like and toxic. And it breaks my heart that it's become something that people who don't know enough about the danger of it actually aspire to, instead of seeing it as like, whoa, 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 like this takes away our very core, who we are as a part of the wild world.
Well, and I think there's something to be said too, going back to something Candy said in your earlier comments about the reaction to diversity as a threat is mm-hmm. often violence mm-hmm. within the setting of Christian nationalism. And not just the threat of violence or violent words and rhetoric, which that exists in spades, but I mean physical violence mm-hmm. and I don't feel like there's a great deal of remorse around that or
Sunday,
an apology around
Sunday morning worship under the strange fruit under the tree, where they would get dressed up in their Sunday's best to go and watch a hanging of a black person.
Exactly.
And then, sit and have a picnic under their hanging bodies.
Yeah. I was reading an interview with a pastor, I want to say it was in Michigan, and his church was very, very tiny. And then all of the rhetoric that happened post-2016 and COVID and masking orders and shutdowns and refusal to shut down in a state that issued orders for churches to stop meeting and all of that, this church just exploded in attendance, hugely exploded, because they embraced talking very violent rhetoric around the harm that diversity is doing and the harm that all these things are doing. And they were talking about aspects of their building, and they rebuilt a building, and they built a shooting range inside of their church space and said, this is how we practice one of our many spiritual disciplines. And like just all of the aspects of that, and like the things that you never thought that would be in a holy space, continue to just blow me away that we've not only accepted that as a new normal, but it's growing in popularity consistently.
I mean, something that is difficult for me to acknowledge as someone who's been drawn to the Christian faith, deeply informed by the teachings of Jesus, is the acknowledgement that Christian nationalism is a religion, and the ultimate concern is the preservation of the power structures of white supremacy.
Which is related to our other favorite topic on our podcast.
Freaking capitalism.
Freaking capitalism.
You know, Phil, I saw an interview with David Bentley Hart, and he said, the only religion that America practices regularly is the love of America. And I thought that was really telling in this idea of, we can't agree on a lot, but like the way that we've elevated patriotism as kind of this make it or break it thing. And anyone who practices that in a way that differs from someone's norm is just completely a threat, as Holly was talking about with diversity, that needs to be silenced or sidelined or destroyed or canceled. I wanna throw something out at you guys. We were talking about the flag earlier and talking about kind of these concepts of idolatry. Does anyone besides me feel like over the last 5-10 years, like the flag now seems to represent things that it didn't represent before? Like, Sherita, I think about the school board meetings, and I think about how people coordinate to wear emblems of the flag as like a sign that I am in defiance of beliefs and opinions in the space.
We talk about symbols, and pledging allegiance to a flag is a symbol. It's a symbol of it's supposed to be a symbol of American freedom. However, today, as a black person in America, when I see a flag on someone's house or someone's car, I get a little nervous. Because that's not a safe space for me. Mm-hmm. That's not a safe space. Those are not safe spaces. When I see an American flag, it means there may be some views in this household, in this space, in this venue, that don't welcome you. And that's what it means to me now. Which is unfortunate, because I haven't grown up like that. I choose not to say the Pledge of Allegiance, not because I hate America, but because of what that flag now stands for me and how I experience it in the world right now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think of how often you see other flags that are represented from a place of like belonging and pride. And I think of people when they, you know, they have ancestry, or they themselves have immigrated from another country, and they display a flag because they are so proud of the country they've come from. And it's this place of like, I just want people to know this about part of my identity and, you know, my family. And you see pride flags and people that are just like, this is, first of all, a safe place. Sports flags. Like, there's just this beautiful solidarity piece of it, and so much of that, and how much the American flag, instead of being a source of pride, is a source of it's like put up for as a threat. And that is just like the disconnect between how we can want to show something publicly that we have just an enormous amount of identity in, and in a way that is like, I want to be inclusive and I want to share this with the world. I want to be a safe space of belonging for people. But then to have others that, in that case, like the American flag, that's literally like a, you're not welcome here if. Like, if you walk into this door, you have to know that this is the belief system, instead of just like, I want you to know this about me. And the disconnect just breaks my heart.
Yeah, there was a study done looking at Confederate flags in the South and how many of them have been now replaced by American flags. And oftentimes, sometimes flying side by side. And, you know, Candy was talking earlier about January the 6th, and you know, the flags that generally were on display, American flags, Confederate flags, don't tread on me, and Christian flag.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that that's something that has become really hard to unpackage. I know my husband and I had a conversation about a year and a half ago. You know, Bob's a veteran and served our country and is proud of that. And we purchased a house to be a respite house for our ministry. And that house had a flag doormat, and it had a flag on the front tree, and it had a flag in the driveway. And there was signage in that house and around that house that made it really clear what that flag meant, right? That it wasn't necessarily I'm proud of serving our country kind of emblem representation. And so after we closed on that house, we quietly removed those things, and we did so respectfully, but it led to a lot of conversations between he and I about like the grief around that. And I've talked to other people who, you know, they love this country. They love what this country has stood for and what this country offers. But the grief that exists in seeing some of those symbols and some of that language and some of those spaces turned into something different.
And it does grieve even me. I didn't grow up with a fear of the American flag. I grew up as a person who would drive across country and know that spaces that they were where there was a Confederate flag, those are spaces we don't stop. Mm-hmm. Now, the Confederate flag and the American flag are at the same spaces. Those are the same stops. It's the same place. Mm-hmm. They have the same beliefs. So now where do I trust to stop? I would love to say, oh, it's American flag, that's a safe space, but that's no longer how I feel. Mm-hmm. And it does grieve me. That's sad.
I think there's so much of our history that has had this consistent theme of oppression, and when you look back, like I had like an ADHD spiral recently where I like went and a thing with calling my mom and wanting to learn more about my ancestry. But some of that comes from a place too of like, I've got little kiddos and I want them to know where, you know, like who they are. And I want that to not just be where you grew up, you know, I don't want that just to be like what you believe and see, but like to also be connected to these pieces of your history and to people that, you know, that suffered and struggled and, you know, did incredible things, and to not lose that, and how much the oppression of being forced to denounce beliefs, being forced to denounce a part of your culture has made this thing where like we today have lost our roots to our ancestors. We've lost our roots to where so often we come from, and just the heartbreak of that. And I remember like as a little girl, we would go visit my great aunt who lived on a farm in Nebraska, and it was this little tiny farming community called Stromsburg, and it was called like the Little Sweden of Nebraska or something like that. But it was where they had an immense amount of Swedish immigrants that had moved there and settled and tended the land there. And so my family was part of the Swedish movement there. And they would have all of these Swedish festivals, and there was still a lot of just rich, rich culture. And my great aunt would teach us the language. And I remember just like walking into these spaces and just feeling this weird sense of belonging, even though I had never once identified with anything with Sweden in my entire life. And it just felt like this really beautiful thing to be like, I know a little piece about who I am. And recently my daughter did a around the world thing in her kindergarten class, and she got picked to represent Sweden. And so she came home with this cute little flower crown with the candles on it. And I told her like some of our ancestors come from Sweden, and she got really excited. And it was just this sense of like innate belonging she felt. And as I was like diving into some of these countries of, you know, Norway, and I have ancestors that came from Ireland and from Scotland, and being curious enough to know like some of the religious culture of a lot of those countries, and being curious enough to know that there is, and you know, and I come from a lot of the European world, how much oppression even my ancestors, and that doesn't even talk about a lot of the other countries where there is a lot more oppression coming over to America, where it's like literally this denouncing of what they believe, where they came from, of traditions, and how much that has caused this incredible loss of who we are and who our roots are, and we don't know who we are anymore as a people, and this like search for identity and something which is being founded then in this incredibly violent, horrific space, instead of being
you know, desiring to know, because I think if we were willing to like look back to the stories that shaped our family a long time ago, we would see different beliefs, we would see different religions, we would see other cultural practices and pieces, and like our ancestors were badass and they were survivors and they were incredible, and like I want to know those stories. I don't want to know these stories necessarily of more hatred and oppression, but like I want to keep those stories alive. And so I think if there would be even just a connection, a movement like within with our upcoming generations to like pour into your ancestry, learn where you came from, there would be a lot more respect for other countries and other beliefs and other religions and a way of learning how to do life differently that we're not doing so well right now.
So Democracy Awakening, Heather Cox Richardson, has helped me to see so many pieces and parts. Like, I want to know the story of the organizers here. I want to know the social justice movements. I want to understand Martin Luther King Jr., yes, but all those that met in the church basements around those movements. Like, those are the people that I want to understand. I mean, go beyond. I love that. And here, even in our country, there have been those movements. And there have been people who have fought and worked so hard to say, that is not our story. So to keep telling those stories and to lean into where that is a part, that is a part of us. So there is this other rhetoric that let's tell those stories. I want that to be what my kids grow up and are inspired by and encouraged by. Here are people who stood up and spoke out and said, yeah, the garbage collectors are not getting paid. We got to speak up. We got to organize and make sure they're getting paid well. Women are getting access to rights. We got to stand up and come together. Like the story, I mean, the Women's March, like that to me was a pivotal moment of saying, in the face of all of this, here are the stories. Here are the people who will stand up and will tell their stories. And that's the identity. Like those that are going to tell the truth and look at each other in love and march in a different way to make sure we all have access and working for everybody. Like those stories. So keep going to our further ancestors, and it's here in our country. 100%. Those stories exist here.
100%. So, I mean, I feel like, you know, those of us around this table, those of us in this room, I know, you know, we could process and process and process about frustrations and anger and angst around kind of the hijacking of the gospel that's being used for political gain, as the way I'm going to phrase it for this. But I also think it's important to not just focus on the negative and the hard. I think it's also important to take a minute to speak prophetically to the hope that I think still exists in this country and the potential that still exists in this nation and healing that I believe in my core is still possible. And so I want to kind of shift us for the last few minutes around this to what is a hope? What is a dream? What is a prayer that you find yourself, Jen, praying for this country, especially in this area of healing around Christian nationalism?
So what gives me hope? The Christian Church Disciples of Christ, as a General Assembly gathering and voting on a resolution and saying, here's what this is, let's define it, let's make sure we're resourced and we have information, and calling the churches to talk about candy going, let's do that. And then a workshop, and then us going, okay, we might have a few people, and then seeing 50 people show up that want to talk about it, that are concerned and go, I didn't know this was a problem, but let's figure this out together. That gives me hope. That encourages me that colleagues who are saying, I'm in my Baptist church, and this is a problem, and I don't know what to do to say it, but I want to keep talking about it. The awakening that I'm seeing. Heather gives me hope on a daily basis. Not just to plug her, but I appreciate the weaving together of the longer story of those who've gone before us and the possibility of what we can do together. Because I know that there is goodness. I mean, we're created in this God, and the possibility within us to dig deeper. And I know when we come together, we can rise. And it's, the stories have been told, and it's happened throughout history. So church is giving me hope. Church is giving me hope. I'm going to say it like that.
I think young people are giving me hope. The young people that, you know, are just loving and just coming out and saying, you know, we're together and we want to solve the climate change. You know, we want to solve the climate problems. We want to solve the problems. We don't want to just run away, which is what they see the elderly, which I am one of them, but but you know, it's like people are running away from all the problems and nothing's getting solved. But I think the young people they really want to work on this stuff, and we need to help them.
So I want to say a bit that just goes back to the post-Civil War era, late 19th century, whenever this phrase started to be used in a lot of sermons being preached in the South. We must take our country back for God. Now, we've heard that a lot over the years. We must take our country back for God. Post-Civil War South, these Southern preachers were starting to feel a little anxiety about maybe the times were changing. Maybe the way in which we've ordered society is coming undone. In other words, maybe the structures of power, we are seeing them, if we're not seeing, tons of change, we are seeing our hold on power waning. And I go back to that to say this about this moment today. I think there's a recognition that the structures of power, as they have historically been centered in the United States, particularly in regard to the way we are becoming a much more diverse country, those power structures are the folk that want to adhere to them are much more anxious about their future. And they sense that the tide is turning, and that's why that so often they are clinging to white supremacy and Christian nationalism all the more to take our country back for God, which we know is code for saying to keep the country pretty much, a straight white cis patriarchal, country. But the heightened anxiety speaks to the way that things are changing. It speaks to the way our country is becoming more diverse. It speaks to the ways that people are coming alongside one another to try to build something better, to try to build something different, to try to move forward in a way that truly, we talk about liberty and justice for all, living into what that might actually mean. People feel threatened by that, but I find hope in the sense that people's anxiety is heightened because it means change is on the horizon. Mm-hmm.
How about you, Sherita?
What gives me hope right now, being in spaces like this, having a space created like our podcast that have a group of people who are moving towards justice, who are leaning into the red letters of Jesus, who are leaning into loving out loud, who are coming together as a community to solve our community's problems. I'm also hopeful based on the deconstruction movement that's happening around our country. I think it's people are starting to ask questions that were previously left unanswered. And those questions are leading people to reframe and move away from the status quo of religion, including nationalism. Mm-hmm. I think those questions are opening doors of connection. Those doors are open. Those discussions and questions are opening doors to inclusion. So that gives me hope.
Yeah, that's good. How about you, Helen?
I think that one of the things that gives me hope is that there has been a much more public movement for the desire for community. There's a huge modern problem in our society that seems to really feel like we're supposed to be so individualistic, and it's this loss of that village mentality. And like, I know for myself, I think the first time I could really pinpoint that was like having small babies and just like, how are we supposed to do this by ourselves, and being so grateful for the community around us that did show up with dinner and showed up with, baby Tylenol when one of them was sick and had advice and just like showed up with coffee. And I vividly remember a season of going over to Christy's house and she being like, I'll stay up with the colicky baby and you go take a nap, and just like the village culture. And there is this movement of, even though people are leaving the church, they are not leaving community. There is, and I wish now that I had could remember where I read it, but I read an article that talked about how so many people had communicated that while I walked away from a church space because it was no longer a safe place and was no longer where I could feel like I aligned with, I'm a part of my local community garden, or I have this group of friends and we meet regularly and we go and we pick up the stream by our school or whatever it is, and like these very holistic, beautiful patterns of gathering that were also benefiting the city and the world, and just like this movement of recognition. And that I think in that community, when we start to share and vocalize, like, well, I don't know how I feel about this incident, or like, this made me really angry, or I'm challenging this belief in community, it's often gives a lot more power, because we often find ourselves a lot more willing to act when you've got people that are with you saying, let's talk about it. I mean, which is honestly how this podcast started, was just like, let's talk about it. We talk about this enough amongst each other as friends. Let's share this with the world. And so I think that community, and then just the fact that, like, there are a lot of good movements and things happening. And I see that the most when I see the world through my kiddos' eyes, because they see the potential. And, like, I'll never forget when, you know, we elected a woman as vice president, and, like, my daughter, we were sitting in her little, like, pink princess tent at that time, and she was just kind of like, I was like, this is, women could not be sitting in the president or vice president seat before this, and she was like, why not? Like, what's wrong with us? Like, come on, world. And, like, her perspective now, her platform is, like, I could do that someday, or my best friend could do that someday. Like, they see, we go to the lake all the time, and my kids, like, pick up the trash just without talking about it, and I watch them on the playground, and they encourage the other little kids to pick up the trash, and it's just this movement of, like, I see the world for what it could be, and they are given the platform to do it, not just because of us, but because other people are paving the path for them, and they see those things. And so those are things that give me a lot of energy and a lot of hope to keep moving forward.
Yeah, I second all of those. I would also add, kind of where you were talking, Sharita, I feel like there is momentum around question asking, and there is momentum in this country around no longer just accepting because the pastor said so, or no longer just accepting because I read it on the news, or no longer just accepting. Like, I feel like there has been momentum around personal accountability to beliefs and belief systems and the repercussions of belief systems. And I think that that excites me and gives me hope, while I acknowledge that that is embedded in tension and hard things. I also feel like there's accountability even in relationships that I'm seeing. I think I touched on this, but we didn't really have a chance to get into it very much. I mean, we have seen families and friendships ripped apart by Christian nationalism and language and differences in beliefs, where we used to find common ground. Now that has become battleground, and lines are drawn and sides are chosen. And I lament that, but at the same time, I feel like there is something happening that's forcing us to at least recognize that something's wrong. Mm-hmm. Whereas a generation, two generations before, it was just, we don't talk about that. We don't talk about religion. We don't talk about politics. We walk around those issues. We don't know what to talk about at holiday meals. But I feel like we're getting into kind of this bottleneck that's forcing conversations that have been way too long avoided in this country. And that's happening not just in congregations, not just in sacred spaces, but it's happening around dinner tables, and it's happening around coffee, you know, shops, and friends having to talk about things. And I think I'm a big believer that conversations are the catalyst for change. And I think we have more people finally being willing to have hard conversations than we've had in the past. Are they easy? Hell no. Are they going to go super smooth? Nope. But if we hang in there and we're committed to conversations, community, relationships, I think there's hope that there's redemption that can come through those connections. So those would be some of my thoughts. Before we leave you tonight, before we end this podcast, we wanted to kind of do a shout out to some resources that might be really helpful. If you are listening to this, or you're here in the room, and you're like, man, this gets me thinking. I want to learn more about this, and where are some good sources to kind of dig into and to lean into. So I had kind of asked each of you to bring some ideas that you might have of resources. So Jen, I want to start with you. I know you already talked about Heather a little bit, and we'll link to all of her work in the show notes so people can find that.
Good one. I feel, particularly as a Christian trying to live out my faith and understand that, Andrew Whitehead's work, American Idolatry, has been one of the most helpful in really informing that. Again, Heather's for the wider view. One I haven't, but I'm really excited to check out, is God and Country, the documentary by Rob Reiner.
Yep.
I really want to do a watch party with folks and have conversations. We'll speak that into space. Because I think that having media like that and other ways to engage, but just to read Andrew's work has been very, very helpful for me as of late.
Awesome. How about you, Phil?
So there are some books out there that I find super helpful. One is called Reconstructing the Gospel, Finding Freedom from Slaveholder Religion. It's by Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove, and just kind of traces Christian nationalism from its earliest days and how we kind of got to where we are now, and provides so many beautiful insights for hope and transformation and really finding a new way forward. It's a beautiful book. Can't help but mention the book by Kristen Dumais, Jesus and John Wayne, and especially from the context of the white evangelical church. And something we might want to link also is the resolution that Jen mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. I love that we're having this conversation in the Disciples of Christ church. I love National Avenue Christian Church so much. I often say, like, if I didn't actually have to be at Brentwood Christian Church, that I would find myself at National Avenue quite often. I love Brentwood. I love National. I love TCG. And just so grateful for the Disciples' witness. You know, we have some colleagues that work really hard on this resolution. You know, kind of shout out to Katie Hayes, Rebecca Littlejohn, pastors and the Disciples, and some others who came alongside them in that work. The resolution, you know, helps differentiate between, like, you know, a healthy patriotism and a dangerous Christian nationalism. It provides really great talking points for congregations or folk just, you know, in their homes, whoever it might be. So I, you know, we might want to link that as well.
Yeah, we'll put that in the show notes as well. Yeah. How about you, Candy? He stole one of your books.
Yeah, he's Jesus and John Wayne. See, I brought it.
Oh, no.
He stole the other one.
And the American Idolatry.
Candy's got good taste in books.
We actually, Jen and I didn't bring any resources. We just saw your books.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, we'll use those first. We get to go first.
There's so many other, there's so much writing going on today. I mean, there's so many articles. I don't know if you're familiar with Substack, but it is an online place where people can write and get ideas and share their ideas. Mm-hmm. And it's really exciting, some of the stuff that's... Diana Butler Bass mm-hmm. is one of my favorites.
She's
and
a great
the woman who wrote Jesus and John Wayne, Kristen Cobus Demez, mm-hmm. she has her own Substack page, and there's several that Jamar Tisby, mm-hmm. He's wonderful.
Yeah.
And so there's just so much out there that it's hard to keep up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Jamar does Pass the Mic through The Witness, and he also has a different podcast that he does exclusively called Footnotes that really takes a look at American history. So he's got a history background, and mm-hmm. it's just brilliant when it comes to kind of unpacking and all of those things. He also wrote the book The Color of Compromise, which
yes.
I highly recommend if
yes.
you've not read that one, because not only does it kind of touch on Christian nationalism, but it really explores kind of like the racist structure and history of the white evangelical church.
Mm-hmm. I think the only thing that I would add to that list is kind of more in the art field, but I have an immense amount of love and respect for the poet Amanda Gorman. She was the poet laureate at the, was it the last election?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And she wrote this beautiful poem called The Hill We Climb. And I read that. I actually have it in the book form now, and I read it every once in a while when I really need that, like, reminder of the beauty that is in our country. And she just has painted such a beautiful perspective of what the prophetic love of America, honestly. It's incredibly beautiful. And then she's released a second book, Call Us What We Carry, I believe is the name of it, and it just came out in paper book form. It came out in hardback a while back.
She but has a children's book.
She has a children's book too. Yeah, that one's phenomenal as well. But she often embeds a lot of social justice, a lot of different themes in her art, and it's very powerful and often very inspiring. And I think for me, sometimes I appreciate an artist's perspective on these kind of topics because it just changes the way your brain experiences things. So I would really recommend it. anything she does.
Yeah, absolutely. So in true book nerd form, I have a few for you. So Tim Alberta just released this book recently, and I just like devoured it in 3 days. It's really, really well written. It's called The Kingdom, the Power, and the Glory. So kind of the background to this book, he was raised as the son of an evangelical pastor, and his dad passes away, and he gives some remarks at his dad's funeral that are not well received in a very conservative evangelical church. And those comments kind of send him on this kind of journey of exploration into Christian nationalism. And he ends up visiting a lot of very familiar names and churches that have been influential in the Christian nationalist movement over the last few years, and kind of sits through these sermons and these experiences. And so he tells each chapter as kind of like a different place he goes to visit. Very fascinating, very fascinating, really good read. Another one I would recommend is John Ward's book, Testimony. And it is the Inside the Evangelical Movement That Failed a Generation. It's a phenomenal book. It's another one that's written kind of more from a news perspective and like research perspective, which I personally really like. And then Ross DeThoot did Bad Religion, How We Became a Nation of Heretics, is another one that I would really recommend. I would also suggest, if you are a podcast person, I really like Jim Wallace's podcast, The Soul of a Nation. I feel like there's some really good, he had a conversation recently with Tim Alberta that was just a really good conversation to listen to. And then also, if you're a documentary person at all, I watched this morning actually, while I was drinking my coffee. There is a movie, or there's a documentary, you can get it on Amazon or on YouTube. It's called JESUSA, and it features a lot of very familiar faces in the deconstruction movement, the progressive movement. Diane Butler Bass is in there. And so it just looks at kind of that history, but it also looks at the current manifestations of things that we're seeing. It talks and focuses a lot on nonviolence and that movement as well. So those would be some resources that I would highly recommend that people check out if you're interested in learning more. So, well, I'm going to channel my inner Phil, and I'm going to end with a quote. we give Phil a hard time because he always comes equipped with like the most massive quote library of all time. But on that podcast that I was listening to, where Jim Wallace was talking to Tim Alberta, Jim makes a comment in this podcast that has just stuck with me for several weeks now. And he says, God is personal, but not private. Hmm. And I want to kind of leave us with that as something for you to ponder in your life, because that idea that we engage with holiness personally, and we have to personalize that interaction with holy text and with sacred spaces and with the divine, but yet that shouldn't be a private practice, and that should inform how we engage with the world and what that looks like. And I think that also goes to what we stand up against and what we're willing to have courage to call out and to name and to speak out for. So I hope that that resonates with you. It has resonated with me. So kind of let that ruminate in your hearts and minds as we close. So we will be back next week with another episode. Thanks all so much for listening.